Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
I'm going to be the envy of all the muso dads now, and lots of other people too, because I get to sit and talk about music and indeed life and stuff with musician, singer, songwriter, broadcaster Tom Dunn. How are you, Tom?
I'm very well, Brendan. Lovely to see you. Thanks very much.
And thank you for picking five songs, which I know the more into music people are, the harder it is to kind of pull back and pick five songs.
It took me a second.
Really? Yeah.
It did, yeah. I actually heard you talking to Charlie McGettigan. I think I might have been painting in the house while I was listening to that.
Yeah.
And as he was picking
songs...
That's how I
imagine people listening. Yeah,
absolutely.
Painting.
As he was,
a landscape or portraiture?
Yeah, I think it might have been a side garden wall. And I was thinking if I was doing that, I'd know my songs. So yeah. I was picking songs at the time. So.
And like Charlie, there are certain people in the Beatles is their band, like, and Charlie obsessed with them. So your first song... Is this the first song you ever remember hearing?
Yeah, absolutely. I can remember I was sick at the time. I had yellow jaundice as a child. And I know they were really fussing over me. They'd made a bed up in the front room. They were so worried. And this was just on the radio all the time. And every time it came on the radio, my two sisters would go, "Do Lally."
Yeah.
That like teenage girl thing of, "Oh my God!" and running towards the radio. So it just stuck in my mind. And it would just, it's still kind of, you drift away during it. I think that's the thing about music that I really love. It just takes you somewhere else. And this was the first time I can remember kind of being taken somewhere else.
Do you remember where Michelle by the Beatles took you?
Just out of that room.
Yeah.
I think into this other world of his beautiful voice. And then it starts to create a picture in your head of who is Michelle and what's all that about. And then he says a few words in French and it all sounds very sophisticated. And you just think, oh, what's this beautiful world and when can I go to it?
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous thing.
Let's have a little listen. The Beatles, Michelle. And then when you actually sit and listen to that properly, you go, how did he come up with that? Like, and the criminal thing is he probably just plucked it out of the air.
I've seen the documentaries since. And apparently when he and John were going to parties and having the crack, they would pull on black polo necks and pretend to be French and sit in the corner. And he thought that sounded French, the piano, or the guitar piece.
Yeah,
so he'd say make up words in French. And then years later, when they were in the studio, they were saying, "You remember that thing you used to play at parties?"
Yeah.
So he finished off and they got a friend to write the French lyrics. Okay. An uncredited friend. Isn't that just the way it goes?
Yeah. Of course. You see, this is the thing about musicians as well. They'll take it from anywhere. Like, on they go. Yeah.
Absolutely. Why wouldn't you?
So listen, I think you're of that generation, just ever so slightly ahead of me, where punk was the big before and after in life,
yeah,
was it?
Totally. I can't describe what that was like. It was such a moment.
Were you a good boy before then?
I think I was a nondescript boy. I wasn't getting into any trouble or anything like that. I was very bookish, very into school, loved school, loved it. Loved reading and books and all them. I had a really amazing teacher, Miles Dungan, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, yeah.
Was our English teacher and our history teacher. And I can remember him walking in the door of school in second year and he had the key, a big beard on him. He looked like he was in a folk band.
Yeah.
And he had a key of a bike. He was late for the first class and he held up this key and you could see it was broken. And he said, "The other half of this is in a Honda 50. That's why I'm late." But he kind of started getting us doing essays and was very, very very encouraging instead of the debating team, and I was on that. So he was a real pivotal force. So I was a good kid, really.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if my parents loved that, to be honest. I think they would have preferred me to get a job quite quickly, to tell the truth. But I loved books and reading, and that was the way it was going to go. But then I was in bed one night. I can remember it. I was in my sister's bed, which sounds more dramatic than it is. She was in the Gaeltacht, and she had a better bed and a better radio.
Yeah. So, so you upgraded when she was
so
there.
So I was in there, and I was listening to
her. It was doggy dog back in those days, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. You could get Terry Wogan on her radio.
Okay.
So that was very important. So I was in there, and late at night I was reading copies of the New Musical Express, like there was going to be an exam in them. I was studying these people, all these hairy bands that I couldn't relate to, Led Zeppelin and stuff. They always looked so hairy and old. And I was reading about them anyway. And then the song came on the radio, and I'd never heard anything like it in my life. I can remember I'd heard mention of a band called the Sex Pistols, and I started thinking, could this be them? And then by the time Johnny Rotten kicked in, I was out of bed and staring at the radio. I'd never heard anything as electrifying in my entire life. So by the next day, I was...
And which song was that?
I think it was Pretty Vacant.
Yeah.
And, you know, I Am an Antichrist. You're going, what? What? What is he even saying? The way he was saying it, the anger, it was just clarion call.
Yeah.
So the next day, I'm outside Mourne Road Church. It's where we lived, Drimna. And you know, you used to hang around outside, and some of the lads would smoke butts, that kind of thing, and not go in.
Right.
So I'm with them, and I'm going through each of them. Favorite band, Sex Pistols, like Sex Pistols? Nope, step aside. Never talk to me again. If anyone said the Eagles, they were dead to me from that point onwards.
Yeah, but you see, it was the Eagles up to then in early
years. I had Hotel California, but
yeah,
that was the end of that.
But the song you picked then is kind of, XTC would be the more intellectual kind of involved wing of that kind of movement.
I kind of think Sex Pistols, it's very jarring. I think if you play it now, you know, people will either have to form a band or turn off the radio. There's no in-between with it.
Yeah.
Whereas I started to fall in love then with XTC. And I remember going to London the first time, and posters for Drums and Wires were up everywhere, and it just looked magnificent. And it still sounds magnificent. And it has that line in it, he's got a future.
It's Making Plans for Nigel, the song,
He's got a future in British Steel. Which at the time, well, I thought it was the cleverest line, because everyone knew British Steel had no future. And it was just, oh man, who are these guys?
Okay, here's XTC Making Plans for Nigel.
We're only making plans for Nigel.
So that's XTC Making Plans for Nigel. That's Tom Dunn's second musical choice today. And you see, in a way, isn't it that the first flush of punk and the Sex Pistols and all that is important, but it's really what it kind of birthed then is probably the better music and everything, isn't it? Because
totally.
As you say, everyone who heard them kind of started a band. And so did you at that point then?
Yeah, absolutely. Me and my best friend Cormac Wright in James Street formed a band called The End, a punk rock band.
Okay, paint the picture.
Well, I think Cormac painted a better picture than he is. He said about 74 gigs to 73 people. At first, very few people came, but then word got around and then nobody came. We were an extreme punk rock band. We wrote our own songs, played at McGonagall's, played The Magnet, supported loads of people. Got a little bit of airplay on the Dave Fanning show at the time. It's a track called Picture Postcard, did really well for us. I used to wear red jeans. I had a leopard skin t-shirt. I had my hair streaked blonde.
Really, yeah?
Yeah, I had a little skinny tie that said piss off. a leather jacket.
You had to make do with what you could get punk-wise.
Pretty much, yeah.
Then,
I used to go into a shop.
Be creative.
There was a school shop on Tava Street where you could get skinny school ties. Go in there and get them. I had a leather jacket and leather jeans as well. They were plastic leather jeans.
Really? Yeah.
Looked the part. And
were you hot?
I don't really know. There was certainly no action going on, that was for sure. I know when we used to support people, the people would leave the venues.
Really?
Honestly, yeah. And I used to carry a newspaper in the back pocket and I used to read it during the guitar solos.
We were there, you know, we were
extreme. But I loved it, absolutely loved it. Did a residency in Toners. I used to go and see U2 in the Bagot and places like that. We'd be playing Toners and smaller venues in the Crofton Airport Hotel.
And were they kind of part of it? It was a punky kind of scene at that stage.
They were always like a rocket taking off. Yeah. You just got a sense of them having an incredible momentum around them from the word go. When we saw them in the Dandelion Market, they had their own PA. They built their own stage. It was 50p in. Every other band was about 25p. It was just, and they were a different level from day one. I remember somebody had spray painted Bono as God on the back wall. We all thought it was Bono had actually sprayed that, to tell the truth. But you saw them again then, and it was just getting better. Every time you saw them, it was just getting better and better. I remember seeing them, and after they'd been in England for about 6 months, they played the Project Arts Centre. And I told anyone who'd listened to me that I'd seen a band that was going to be one of the biggest bands in the world. There was no question about it. They were off the clock. Okay. So they were a different level to everyone else.
Okay. And so the end...
we're never at that level.
It ended. And when did something happen start then?
I was in college when the end broke up. We got 2 years in college when it made life really difficult for me. I was doing engineering. And I was kind of heartbroken.
Stuck with your own education, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The band was the least likely outcome for your life.
Yeah.
You know, you have to. That was like running away to join the circus. It wasn't something you took seriously. It was, you might love it. It might be your greatest passion. But you didn't for a second think you were going to make a living out of it. And punk was that was part of the punk ethos as well. It wasn't a commercial thing. It was it was to be pure and write about something that's in yourself. All the real things, I felt. So I never thought it had a snowball's chance in hell. So when the end broke up, I thought, well, there you go. That confirms that. So I was kind of heartbroken, but, you know, knuckled down to engineering and became an engineer for a bit. And then the drummer in the end was haunting me and saying, you're crazy. You're not going to gigs. You're not getting out. The Smiths have arrived. You're missing all this. So he said, there's these three lads and they've been looking for a singer for a year. So he said, meet them, just meet them. So I met them. After an emotional telling him, John, I've nothing else to say. I've said it all in the end. So I went down, I met the lads, Ray and Alan and Damon, and we just started playing and I couldn't get over how good they were. And they were a dream for me because they literally didn't write words and they had maybe 20 instrumentals. I was going in.
You were the icing on the cake.
I just wrote words.
Yeah.
So I was going in, and suddenly the songs had names because now they had lyrics. So it was great. The first song we wrote was Burn Clear, and Dave Fanning played it something like 11 nights in a row. And it was great. It was so good to be back in a band. I remember going to my girlfriend and just saying, I'm in a band again.
Yeah.
We're okay. I just felt reconnected to where I should be.
Who you really are.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. It was so much, because it seems to influence everything in your life. The films you watch, the books you read, how you dress. You know, it's
okay. It's a whole identity,
it is.
So you're not an engineer, like
no.
You're going about, so was it hard then? But I sense you have a kind of a bourgeois mindset at the back of the Bohemia, where you were clinging on to engineering. Was it hard to let that go?
No, surprisingly easy. I know what you mean, and I think like I resigned from engineering to sign to Virgin Records. There was no...
Okay, so you had another horse on the go kind of before you jumped.
There was no romantic living in a flat, starving for our art moment. And I had to resign from the chief engineer in Aer Lingus, and he looked at me and said, why would Virgin Music need a mechanical engineer? there's no real answer to that, was there? So, and that was the most incredible experience. Like, I did. Aer Lingus was a lovely place to work and all that was great. But going into a room to try and write songs with your friends, that was a whole different
level. And not having to do anything else.
No. Yeah. We started on the first day at 9 a.m. rehearsing. It's in you. And we didn't write a song for about 6 months. We couldn't get it. It's like the moment we went professional. Every single idea we'd ever had dried up, and that was a bit of a scary.
Oh, really?
Scary
yeah.
A few months. Yeah. And then the first song we wrote was Take This With You. Yeah. And it broke the log jam, and we were back in the game. And that was an amazing experience. It really was. Tommy Ramone produced the first album, and the second album was recorded. I know. Isn't that just incredible?
Yeah.
And the second album was over in LA, working with a great producer over there, and toured America 14 times, two of them 3 months long. One of them at Warren Zevon. They're incredible life experiences.
I bet, yeah. Like they say, the trying to break America thing is grueling, but I'd say
it is grueling.
Fantastic fun, too, is it?
It is fantastic fun, where every night is Saturday night, and you're in this big tour bus, and you're driving, and you're seeing the great American countryside outside the window, and you can go to bed at, say, 2 a.m, and you're driving through a desert, and you can wake up at 9, and you're still driving through a desert. It's America's a phenomenal country. I mean, you're driving around places like Colorado or San Jose or LA or San Francisco, and you're just seeing it in that way. It's an incredible experience.
Yeah, how old are you at that point?
Would have been about 26, 27 at that point.
Yeah, so old enough too to kind of appreciate everything that was happening. Yeah.
Totally.
We'll come back to the musical kind of thing, the Americana kind of thing, which is a big influence on you. You never broke up since then.
As Alan, you say, we were too disorganized. when you have a rise and a fall, there's no getting away from that.
Is that, that's band. Just how it
just
is.
It happens, yeah. There's no, even for you two, there were moments where they weren't the flavor of the week anymore. Before Octing Baby, they were nearly breaking up and stuff. So it happens in all bands. And it's hard. It's hard. You go from playing a big venue to playing a smaller venue. That's not easy for your ego.
Okay.
All those things are hard. Character forming, I would describe them as now in retrospect.
Yeah.
And very often bands turn on themselves during that. And you start to blame each other. You know, if you were better at this, we wouldn't be having that problem and all those things. But somehow we didn't get too bad at it. And then we all slipped into other kind of jobs. And then we kept the band up. We kept going back to play. We loved the gigs. So we just managed to get through it without having to take each other out or, you know, try and murder each other. And thank God, because the bond with those guys now is one of the strongest bonds I have in my life. It is a brotherhood. It is. They're closer to me than any other friend. They are like family to me, and they know things about me that not many other people know. They see me probably at my best and my worst, and it's incredible.
Yeah, that's a great thing to
have. It is good. We went to a
rehearsal. And the performing, like, it's still...
Performing is...
What's the board?
I think they're a great band. I hope they take that well. I think...
Your band.
I think Ray Harmon is a sensational guitar player. I think Al's brilliant on the bass. And Eamon is the founding member, the rock of... to stand in between them when they play music is a magnificent experience.
I'll stop, you give me the heebie-jeebies. I can imagine, yeah.
You're at the sharp end of this thing. You're leaning in towards the crowd. You're the, kind of directing this really powerful band. And Alan Connor now playing guitar with this as well. It's a magnificent experience. And I love it.
Yeah.
You know? And there's songs we wrote and, you know, you were saying where the songs take you. The songs we wrote take me to very specific places.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I love, because I'm not the same man. I'm much older now.
Yeah.
So you're thinking where you were then. Well, I remember a beach in particular in a cinema in Manhattan. I remember that cinema.
Yeah.
I remember the girl in the black dress.
Really, yeah.
Like that was an actual girl walking up a cinema. And I'm just thinking, I got a feeling that day that you're on this cusp in your life where you can do all these different things. And it's wildly exciting. And looking back on it now, I still feel, God, that was brilliant, wasn't it? Mm. It was great to be there. So, yeah, it's a wonderful experience.
I was listening back to that song, actually, and lots of songs in the last few days. And, like, you can say it.
I can say it
yourself. Yeah, but they were...
I think there's times when you're trying to flick a coin into a jar from across the room, on the occasion when it actually goes into the jar,
it all comes
I think
together.
You can stand back and say, we did it there. That's a good one. Yeah. And it is a good one. I love it.
David Bowie, Starman, is the next choice. What is it about Bowie?
That was the beginning of my kind of retreat into the upstairs bedroom, really. Right. Or I was studying. I seemed to be studying all the time. I got very studious. I really wanted to do well. And I would create this little room, a tiny box room in Drimna. And when Bowie, Ziggy Stardust album was on, a little cassette of that, I was in a parallel world up there. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was like, I never wanted to leave that room. And Bowie, that album where it starts with 5 years and that paints that picture of the world is going to end in 5 years. And you're wondering what's going on here. And then Bowie is like this alien, brilliant creature from outer space. It was just, again, that escape into this world where you could just, it would end and you just put it on again. It was no wonder I was going to do well in exams.
Do you know every beat and every noise and every pause in that record is like in your your body practically?
And I got to interview Woody Woodmansey, the drummer on it.
Yeah.
And I say, what was Bowie saying to you?
Woody's bitter, isn't he? As I remember.
He didn't come across as bitter.
I think Woody has had his issues down the years. Like, they feel they were kind of a bit ill-treated.
They were jettisoned,
weren't they? Yeah.
That's just the way it was going to
be. So go on anyway. Woody,
he told me, Bowie just told him to play like you're depressed.
So, like, really, that would be the note for half the music ever written.
Yeah,
just
totally.
Play like you're depressed.
It's nice to get that actually expressly said, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but this isn't depressing, I don't think.
This is wonderful. This is one of the tracks that changed the course of music. His appearance on Top of the Pops performing this.
Yeah.
The number of people to trace being in a band to that moment.
Yeah.
Def Leppard, Gavin Friday, you two, all of them saw this and said, who's that man? And how can I get into that business? Yeah.
And I've seen that clip so many times, but I can never see it for the first time, not knowing who he is the way you guys did. It's an exciting thing. So here's Starman.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low. I leaned back on my radio. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll at a solar set. The loud sound that seemed to fade came back like a slow voice on a wave of fate. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy cosmic time. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a
never gets old, does it?
Never gets old. Just sounds so fresh. And Bowie was just on fire then, on fire.
Yeah. I have this theory. We can't get into it now, but I have a theory that 20 to 30, a lot of people between the age of 20 and 30 do this, like Bowie did, this run of incredible work.
Dylan would have done the same.
Chasing the dragon for the rest of it. And they hit it sometimes. But those 10 years can be magic for people. Yeah. Listen, you're not 20 or 30 anymore and into adult grown-up stuff.
Yeah.
So every second person you meet now has a stent, like no big deal.
Yes.
You had heart surgery, but it was the serious end of the scale, yeah?
Yes, indeed. I had to have my aorta replaced, which is the central valve in the middle of your heart. It was a genetic defect. It was always going to happen. It was discovered in 2007 during a routine medical, and I failed it. And they were saying, you've a murmur, do you know you've a murmur? And I was going, what are you on about? And then went to a cardiologist and he did a test and said, yeah, you've got a bicuspid valve. Everyone has three flaps in their aorta. You've got two, and that's going to age your aorta, and you're going to get stenosis. And at some point, we're going to have to fix that. Stenosis is it's the calcium forming inside it, and it starts to restrict.
Okay.
And it can just stop. That's why it's so dangerous, and why anyone listening to this of a certain age should get their heart checked, because I had no symptoms whatsoever. No out of breath, no dizziness, nothing.
Okay, but just one day you...
One day it'll just stop. It just won't be able to open or close and you'll be gone. So that was discovered in 2007, but there was no real timeline on it. It was kind of see how you go. You've mild stenosis at the moment. It's someday you'll have severe stenosis, and we just need to watch as it progresses. So I was getting annual checks, and there was nothing going on, and he was constantly saying stay fit and cycle and do anything else, you know, look after your diet, but do whatever you want was the general advice. And then I got a little bit blasé because every year I'd go every 2 years and there was no real change. So I missed 1 year in particular, and then when I went back, it had all changed. It had just all changed really quickly. And he said,
"Did you get an awful fright, do you?"
I did. I felt very stupid. I felt like I'd had noticed a few little bits of being slightly out of breath. And I just had gone. It was inconvenient for me to go to the cardiologist. That was literally, you know. So I felt if I was going to die, it was going to be stupidity that was actually going to kill me.
And were you thinking I might die here? Yeah, that's a very
it did cross my mind. Yeah. All right. Now the cardiologist and the surgeon were saying, "Look, you're not. That's not going to happen." But you're thinking, yeah, right. You would say that. So then he said you need to go and see the surgeon. I thought he had a very relaxed... I honestly felt he meant in the next year or two, but he meant there and then. So when I went to see the surgeon, he kind of realised that I wasn't taking this very seriously. And he said, "I need to see you in two weeks. And I was going, "I have a gig in Whelan's though. You know, that's in 2 months. I really want to do that." And he taps the readings and he says, "These readings, 70% chance of dying in the next 2 years." So I thought, you have my full attention now. What did you say about the 2 weeks? So I have to make an appointment there and then. And November the 18th was the date, 5 years ago now. And it was very nerve-wracking. It was very tough on my wife in particular. I didn't tell the kids. I made up a kind of cock and bull story. I just didn't want them worried.
Yeah.
And went in and went for it. There was no... They say it's... They call it kind of pulling the trigger because you go in... The way I am now, and then a few days later, you're not like that anymore. They've opened your chest, they've stopped your heart. That's about a 6-hour procedure, I believe. They replaced the aortic stem, and they bypassed one valve as well. So when I came to from that, 6 days had passed. It's 6 days in ICU, and that was a shock. When I saw myself in the mirror when I went to go for a shave, that was a shock. But then I was starting to turn a corner. You kind of accept it very fast. I went in for the shave, which I'll never forget. It was like stitches everywhere and blood. And you kind of go, "Jesus, what happened to you?" I'm hit by a bus is what it looks like. And I just started turning the corner and doing as I was told and trying to make progress. It was very traumatic, and you have a bit of post-traumatic stress after it.
I can imagine. Yeah,
you're a bit emotional.
You see the fear in guys' eyes sometimes after something like that.
Everyone said I looked haunted.
Afterwards, yeah,
and I did.
Yeah, not anymore.
No.
Okay, listen.
I can't get over how
I've been very unprofessional here. Yeah, really, yeah. Fantastic.
Full
okay, that's good for people to hear, yeah. I have talked to you too much, so you have two more choices. REM sitting still or Boy Genius.
I'm going to go with Boy Genius.
Yeah.
Because it's brand new. It's from this year, and I think Phoebe Bridgers is just a genius. I love her way with words. And she's so modern, you know. She's writing from this perspective of when she says, "I'm not strong enough to be your man." Man is just a term now. It's not a male or a female. It's just a vision of a strong person in a relationship. I just love that playfulness with the whole thing. So I think she's just Boy Genius are brilliant, and the song they did with Eve Vagabonds is wonderful.
Yeah. I also think there's an aspect to that song in particular, "Not Strong Enough," that it sounds like a great indie song from
the
ones we would have loved.
The first verse is the best first verse I've heard in decades.
Before we get to it, you and Fake No Brain On are in the Pavilion Theatre on December 2nd, 3rd and the 9th.
Yeah.
And then Something Happens are in Kilkenny on December 27th. You're in Galway on December 28th. So reasonably full dance card for December then.
I have to say now, myself and Fake and Alan were supposed to be in Glore last night. Sadly, Fake's dad, Henry, passed away last Wednesday. So we've had to reschedule that, and obviously deepest sympathies to Fiacna and
absolutely
his family,
and so say all of us. Okay, Tom Dunn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brandon.
Here's Boy Genius.